אתם עם SBS בעברית. לעוד סיפורים מעניינים, כנסו ל-sbs.com.au.
Michael Ben-Meir is a dedicated healthcare professional with the Royal Flying Doctor Service, bringing critical medical care to some of Australia's most remote communities. With years of frontline experience, he joins us here today to share his insights into the challenges and rewards of delivering healthcare across vast distances and what drives his commitment to this vital work. Michael, welcome to SBS Hebrew.
Hey, Marielle. Thanks very much for having me.
Michael, you've been involved in medicine in different capacities over the years, with some notable roles as the director of the emergency department at Cabrini Hospital in Melbourne, where you worked for almost 10 years, is that correct?
As director, yeah, but I was there for 8 years prior to that, working as a doctor as well.
You also worked as a clinical associate professor at Melbourne and Monash Universities, and now you're the CEO of the Royal Flying Doctor Service. They're all distinctly different forms of medicine, and I'm pretty curious to know what are some of the highlights of your career.
I think if you do emergency medicine, you innately have a short attention span and get a little bored easily. That may inform why I've done so many different things in different places. I do like the depth and breadth of medicine in all its forms, both in terms of clinical medicine and all the ranges of clinical medicine, from pediatrics to obstetrics, anesthetics, acute resuscitation, and then general medicine and all the subspecialties and surgical ones as well. So they're all interesting to me. You get to see them all in an emergency department every day. So honing in on one alone was never going to work for me and the way my mind works. But then beyond clinical medicine, there's administration of services, so there's service design. And when you start getting into running departments, you understand the complexity of service design, but the real value when you can design services that are better for patients, better for the system, and better for the entity you're working for, whether it's a hospital or an ambulance service or anywhere else. So that really started to spark my interest. Education, training, and research have always been an interest. You know, when you go through medicine, you're in training until you're in your early or mid-30s. So your whole life has been education, and it doesn't really ever stop. So you're always reading, you're always learning. So going and doing other forms of learning outside of traditional medical learning, like an MBA or leadership courses, and mixing with non-healthcare professionals, was really, really enlightening and brought great perspective back into healthcare and healthcare management. So the research side of things really became as a product of all of that learning and management and wanting to do things in a better and more effective, efficient way that ultimately was develop better outcomes for patients. So started off by doing acupuncture research, actually, when I was still working as I wasn't even finished my specialist qualification, but was very interested in pain management. And pain in an ED is pretty common. It's probably the most common reason people present to an ED. They're in pain somewhere. And we did a multi-center acupuncture trial to look at the effects of acupuncture in migraine, ankle sprain, and back pain, and found that it was...
Doesn't acupuncture work over a period of time, or is it as immediate as it needs to be?
Well, we found it was as effective as standard care in terms of dropping pain scores, and at day two, people were actually slightly better off. Those that got acupuncture alone needed a bit more breakthrough pain, so it never quite took off, but it can work acutely, and it can work for chronic pains as well. So that was my initial taste of research, and got me quite excited and interested. And over the time, I've done research in health service design. So we implemented a follow-up phone call program at Cabrini. So you'll know when you go to an emergency department, you're often rushed out because there's often a queue and people need to be seen. You know, you may well have had some medicines to treat your pain. You're not in the clearest state of mind. You don't always remember everything. And you're asked to make appointments and other actions after you go, and you might forget, or the appointment might not be possible. You know, that doctor you referred to might be away, for example. So the plan, we don't know how well people stick to plans when they leave an emergency department, and we don't know what they remember about what we tell them. So we implemented a phone call system the next day where everyone was contacted, turned into a text where we asked, you know, are you clear? Have you made any appointments? Are there any questions you want to ask about what happened yesterday?
Is that from an administration perspective, just a follow-up telehealth kind of check-in?
Started as a phone call, moved to texting. There's a staff member there that you can talk to that's dedicated to the people who were seen the day before to make sure that their plan is being enacted and that they're actually getting better and they're not deteriorating. That's the other thing we found. When you've sent home from an ED, the threshold to go back in terms of how bad your symptoms have to be is actually a bit higher than the original threshold of deciding to go in the first place.
Why would that be?
Because you've been there, you've kind of been reassured to a degree that it's not a life threat, but early deterioration is something we were hoping to catch with this phone call as well. And to a degree it does, because we bring people back, because not all things track in the right direction. Some things do get worse. You're not bad enough to stay. We don't know what it is, but if it does get worse, you should come back. That's a very common thing you'll hear said in an emergency department. So that program, you know, was quite successful. I think it won a healthcare award through the Victorian government. And it's still running today. So I got a real taste for service design and optimizing service design. We started doing research in scribes at Cabrini as well, ever since computers have come in and doctors have to engage with computers more. You'll see doctors everywhere sitting in front of terminals instead of sitting in front of patients. And we were finding emergency departments, that's about 60% of the doctor's time is in front of the terminal.
I was going to ask you, they're a limited resource, each doctor, and within that time frame of doing all the admin work, couldn't they be attending to other appointments, or is there a way to short circuit that?
Well, we thought back 10 years ago that human scribes would be a great way to free them up, and we demonstrated that and published that in the VMJ. But now we've got AI scribes, which are a real game changer. And, you know, doing some research now in this new role about how we can use AI to decrease our administrative time spent as clinicians and increase the amount of time we can spend with patients, which is where our real skills are. And to be honest, no clinician likes engaging with digital systems. Like, data entry is not what floats our boat. So there are new tools, and you know, that progression of technology, medical technology and software technology, in particular AI, is really going to change the world, and it'll definitely change medicine. And it was one of the big reasons I found great interest in this role. So bridging distance is kind of the key role of the Royal Flying Doctors. You know, we service those who are very far from metro communities, very far from where all the core services are. And that makes the delivery of really good medicine very, very difficult, because it's all about staff. You know, medicine is all about expertise, and traditionally, you know, the patient and the staff member need to be in the same room for it to work really well. Increasingly, we're finding, you know, COVID showed us telehealth really does have a role to play in healthcare service provision.
This isn't a telehealth, though. The Royal Flying Doctor Service it's more of a rural and remote service. So for people living off the grid or in the outback. I just want to backtrack just for one moment, because I don't want anyone having any assumed knowledge on what this service actually provides. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Royal Flying Doctor Service and what the actual service entails?
Clearly what we're known for is the flying of services into remote areas and delivering services there, or bringing patients back into environments where those services are delivered. So that's what we call retrievals. And we're known for that. But increasingly over the last few decades, it's pretty clear that that in and of itself is not going to make an impact on the big gap between healthcare access in those areas and healthcare access in metro. So the title of our service is not the purpose of our service. Our purpose is to bridge the gap in access and equity of healthcare service delivery in Australia. And the gap is huge. So the life expectancy difference if you're born in remote Australia compared to if you're born in metro Australia is 16 years.
And what does that come down to?
Healthcare access is a big component of it. There are many other reasons. You know, there's There's educational reasons, there's cultural reasons, there's other services beyond healthcare. Clearly, healthcare access is a big component of that. And probably the biggest component of healthcare access is not the ability to retrieve you when you're really, really sick. It's the ability to get you good, ongoing preventative medicine, management of the illnesses that you have, and good secondary prevention. You know, so if you do have diabetes, really good tight management of your diabetes. Yeah, so the diabetes doesn't cause trouble. You know, if you do have heart disease, good secondary prevention so you don't get another heart attack.
So it's one thing to respond to people's emergencies if they're living off the grid, but it's another thing to have healthcare maintenance or this sort of healthcare hygiene, so to speak. And people probably delay those services purely because of their location. So where does the Royal Flying Doctor Service get involved and how can they bridge that gap?
The metaphor I give is, you know us as the group that come and pick you up off the ground after you've fallen off the cliff. But we're increasingly the group that sticks a fence up the top of the cliff so you don't fall in the first place. So what does that mean? That means putting services in rural and remote communities. That means taking services to them that are permanent. They're not fly in, fly out. So we have GP clinics in rural Victoria. We have speech pathology, mental health, dental services that go out to communities and service them where they are rather than bringing them into town. And increasingly, that's where we want to get involved. We'll still do all the transport. So we do the aeromedical transports in Victoria. We also do a lot of road transport. So we're an ambulance service in that sense. But we're also what we would call a primary healthcare service. And a big part of getting services in now is what we can innovate and how we can use telehealth and medicine, what we call med tech, the increasingly interesting technologies that can be used over the web to give us really, really good data about patients. So at the moment, it's a FaceTime call. In the coming years, there'll be an enormous amount of data you'll be able to get off the patient through the camera, which is going to make management remotely really, really interesting and will have a lot more capability.
And it'll be much more streamlined as well. Yep. As a service. Michael, can I just ask from your perspective, what are the most pressing issues facing people living in rural or remote parts of the country?
Well, from a healthcare point of view, it's access. So in many towns in Victoria, you can have an up to 10-week wait to book into a GP. Now, if you've got a kid with croup or, you're sweating and you can't swallow because you've got tonsillitis, that's just not viable, right? So where do you go? You end up at an emergency department or an urgent care centre. Now, there might not be one in your town, which means you have to go to the next town or the one after that. So getting there, getting back, all of these things become real problems. That's great difference in access. Whereas if you're in metro, it's not about whether or not you can get into a GP today or tomorrow or an ED. It's about, well, which one suits me?
Absolutely.
They don't have that.
The disparity in that is quite shocking to think about.
Yeah.
Are you working at all with the Aboriginal communities?
RFDS nationally has a huge impact and relationship with Aboriginal communities. Many of the remote areas in Australia, and by definition, Victoria has no remote. There's a scale that determines what remote is by definition, and there's no land in Victoria or Tasmania that's defined as remote. Only about 5% of New South Wales is defined as remote. So remote Australia is really Western Queensland, most of Northern Territory and probably about two-thirds of South Australia and a huge part of Western Australia. And those services, a significant percentage and up to a majority of their patients are First Nations people. So nationally, RFDS has a huge relationship. Victoria, the bulk of First Nations people, the majority of our population actually live in the city. There are significant populations around the state and they have healthcare services called UCHOs, and increasingly we're keen to develop relationships with them and working on services that we can augment what they have in the state. But it's fair to say that both Aboriginal communities in rural Victoria and non-Aboriginal communities have great access issues. They are very similar in that regard.
And what would you say some of the resources that the Royal Flying Doctor Service is lacking?
I think the big issue with regional and rural healthcare is workforce, and the second biggest issue is workforce, and the third biggest issue is workforce. It's everything. Getting good people to live and work in these communities is hard, but not so much because of the communities themselves, but the services are not just lacking in health services. There's schools and recreation and other professional services that aren't there. And that means getting a professional to take their family there and move there is really tricky. And that's the big issue. So any ways we can partner with communities or partner with other
universities, even
unis and other services to make the idea of going and working there really more attractive is really part of what we're trying to do. And there will always be those areas where that's not going to be possible, and we just have to fly people in and fly them out. And we'll do that because we're not here to make a profit from our work. We're here to make an impact. So we're lucky in that we have great donors and benefactors that enable us to deliver services where the market just won't, because they're loss-making ventures. In order to do that at scale, that's a significant impact. There's probably 20 clinics like the one we've got in Robinvale that we could do, but there's a limit to what our philanthropy can enable.
I was going to ask you about the funding of the system and how you exist, actually, but thank you for answering that. We do live in a very big country, so you can't service every single corner of Australia. Last question, I just wanted to know, the service operates in all the states bar the ACT. Do you think different states are better equipped at dealing with rural and remote medicine services? And the second part of the question, are there specific gaps in the national healthcare system that you think need urgent attention, whether that's funding or staffing or infrastructure?
The funding of healthcare is really interesting. Obviously, federal and state have different areas that they fund, but there's enormous crossover. And if you're a patient, you don't necessarily know when you're going from a service federally funded to state funded to self-funded to insurer funded to council funded. You just know what you need. And that's a complexity in our healthcare system that generates gaps, duplication, and probably inefficiencies. But that's the structure, right? It's no one's fault, and it's a hard structure to untangle and fix. And the gaps we see are, the further you get from metro, the more specialized or the less specialized services you have is the short story. In Cabrini, I've got a list of probably 35 specialists on call 24/7.
Right. Can you just describe Cabrini for our non-Melbourne listeners?
Cabrini is a large private hospital, including maternity, a huge surgical elective and emergency department attached now for 25 years. It's probably one of the more sophisticated private EDs in the country. And but it's private. It's in a fairly well-to-do part of Melbourne. The disparity between delivering services there, say, compared to delivering services in Robinvale, which is a town on the Murray, about an hour upstream from Mildura, it's stark. The difference in access to opinion, to personnel, to staff, to diagnostic capabilities, couldn't get more stark, the difference.
You started off a conversation by saying that you were very interested in business. What part of your job right now interests you the most? Would you say the medical part, or would you say the business part?
The problems are there because they're really hard to solve. Yeah, I'm not the first or the brightest person that's come in to this sector to try and bridge the gap of access across this big country. Many people have been working on it for a really long time. So the really interesting thing for me is I'll talk about service design, but ultimately that's a business design. Right, so because you need funding, right? Where is the payout? Where is the money coming from to enable services to be delivered in areas where markets are really thin or markets have failed? How do you develop partnerships arrangements and how does the money flow to enable that solution to be scaled. So to me, that's a really fascinating business problem. Yeah. But it's a business problem that if solved can deliver great healthcare to people that don't have it. That's the exciting thing for me. How can we build different models, use new technologies, develop different kinds of relationships and or different kinds of financing structures to enable the big and long-term and really tricky problems to start to have some novel solutions. That's the exciting stuff for me. And that involves a whole range of skills, and business management is clearly one of them.
And you want to be part of a solution?
Absolutely. I really do. I'm here to make, you know, I think there's a great need. And to me, there's an excitement in giving it a red hot crack to try and meet that.
Wonderful. Dr. Michael Ben-Meir, thank you so much for joining us here on SBS Hebrew.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me.
רוצים לשמוע עוד סיפורים? האזינו דרך האפל פודקאסט, גוגל פודקאסט, ספוטיפיי, או בכל מקום אחר בו ניתן להאזין לפודקאסטים.